Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. For our opening words this morning, I'm going to steal words from Live Oak Unitarian Universalist Church. It's in a suburb about 30 miles from Austin, Texas. We're the kind of church with free thinkers, Buddhists, atheists, Christians, pagans, agnostics, Hindus, babies, old folks, introverts, everyone in between, patriots, anarchists, extroverts, straight and LGBT folks, BBQ fanatics, vegans, a pub, and I'm gonna change it, karaoke gang, social justice activists, musicians, artists, engineers, accountants, a whole bunch of loving people committed to a free and responsible search for truth and meaning and making the world better. You may be interested in knowing that their website has two different names. One is, of course, liveoaku.org. The other is thatkindofchurch.org. Pam Gates will read our opening words this morning.
No real belief, however trifling and fragmentary it may seem, is ever truly insignificant. It prepares us to receive more of its like, confirms those which resembled it before, and weakens others. And so gradually it lays a stealthy train in our inmost thoughts, which may someday explode into overt action and leave its stamp upon our character forever. This is by W.K. Clifford in The Ethics of Belief.
Our chalice lighting this morning will be done by Heidi Hughes and Rachel Hughes.
We light our chalice this morning, the anniversary of a day painful to remember but impossible to forget. We remember all the heroes and heroines of that day, the firefighters and emergency responders who demonstrated such courage in the midst of crisis. We remember the innocents who perished, our friends and neighbors, and the thousands of strangers who were victims of random violence. We remember knowing for a moment that we were connected to each precious life, to the survivors and to those who died, with a bond of shared humanity that the forces of hate could never break. We remember the voices that counseled peace, even as our nation prepared for war. And we raise our voices still against fanaticism in all its forms, against jihad, against militarism, against racism and religious intolerance, praying that the conflagration of that day might even now cast a more gentle light, leading to a future where all people can live in freedom and without fear.
Looking to that great font of human wisdom, Wikipedia, a philosopher is someone who practices philosophy which involves rational inquiry into areas that are outside of either theological dogma or science. The term philosopher comes from the ancient Greek, meaning lover of wisdom. Its origin has been ascribed to the Greek thinker Pythagoras. In the classical sense, a philosopher was someone who lived according to a certain way of life, focusing on resolving existential questions about the human condition, and not someone who discourses upon theories or comments upon authors. We have a philosopher amongst us, Matt Tedesco, who is going to talk a little bit this morning about the free and responsible search for truth and meaning in our UU principles. Matt, welcome, and thank you for coming this morning.
So, you know, my favorite definition of a philosopher, actually, I'll share with you, is someone who answers questions that come naturally to children with methods that come naturally to lawyers. So maybe that. My name is Matt Tedesco. As Al mentioned, I'm a philosophy professor at Beloit College, for those of you who don't know me. When Penny asked me a few months ago if I'd be interested in talking about this principle. We've got this series going on, you know, a regular series of talking about the different principles, the seven principles of UU, and I couldn't resist. I was looking back. This is actually, I think I gave my first talk here back in April of 2014. This is my fifth. This is five, 2.5 years. And I'm really worried that I'm sort of overstaying my welcome, as it were. But like I said, I couldn't resist. This principle in particular, as soon as she asked me, I thought, well, there's just so much to say here. Of course, I've got to say yes. This will be fun. And then I went home and thought about it and sort of distressed because there's so much to say here. And so, Kim, could you hit the next slide? So here's, you know, so going home that day, actually, and starting to think about this principle, it strikes me there's at least four interesting pieces. And I say at least because I'm not going to talk about the process of searching in and of itself, though that could be interesting. I suppose if you're really into articles, I'm not going to talk about words like a and the. But the remaining words of this principle, I think all of them are really interesting. That is, you can sort of think about the principle sort of in two halves. You've got, you know, what we're searching for, and there you've got two really, really interesting concepts, truth and meaning. And then you've got the piece about how we should be searching for them. That is freely and responsibly, where I just sort of tag on there. You can't even read it probably, but you know, notice that is a kind of a normative claim, right? That's it's not just any old search, right? That we ought to be searching in a way that is free and responsible. And so it strikes me that these are all really interesting pieces. And in fact, I wouldn't do this because then I would overstay my welcome. I mean, I think each of them could be like a whole service in and of themselves. In fact, you could do a whole course on each of these. So what I thought I would do today, instead of, I mean, the two options were really to dive deep into one of these pieces or to kind of bounce along the surface a little bit and just say something, I hope, provocative and interesting about all of them. And to do it in a way that maybe will be interesting to you, give you something to think about, maybe give us all something to talk about. We'll have some time afterwards to sort of chat together. And so that's anyway my goal. And so I mean this as a kind of, I don't know, preface, maybe a bit of an apology, right? I mean, what I'm going to say will be somewhat quick about each of these. And there's just a heck of a lot more to say about all the pieces. I'll also say, to whatever extent this is sort of an oddly shaped PowerPoint or it's stretched out in odd ways, we had a devil of a time getting this technology to work. I never use PowerPoint. I like a chalkboard because they don't fail you. But we're rolling with the technology today. So let's just get into the pieces here. So I sort of see what I'm trying to do today as having two main parts. First off, what I guess I want to suggest is when you think about those two main pieces, what we're searching for and how we're searching for them, as I thought more about it, it seemed to me one way to kind of organize my thinking about this principle anyhow, is that each side of that equation involves something primarily about us and something primarily about sort of the world around us and how we're engaging with it. And what I want to suggest is, or at least what I'll say here, is that in three of those four pieces, the bar is maybe deceptively high, both for what it means for us and how we're engaging with the world, but then also what our sort of role is in the world. And that'll become clear as I move along. So maybe let's get into the pieces here. And in some ways, I think I'm going to do this in reverse. And so I want to start by talking about sort of what we're searching for according to this principle. And then back into sort of how we're searching for it. The meaning piece we could say a lot about. This is the one I'm going to probably say the least about of all four of them. So first off, and how I'm organizing it, you sort of see here, I guess the idea I want to suggest is that in what we're searching for, these two pieces, truth and meaning, this one says something primarily about us. That is, in how we sort of engage the world and what we find meaning in. I take it from person to person in this room and beyond, we find different kinds of meaning in very different kinds of things. And that strikes me as entirely appropriate. That is sort of right on the money, right? So, and so I guess when I say here, this is the piece where I argue the bar isn't high, I guess what I want to suggest here, and then move on, though we can come back to it later, is that I think we ought to embrace the idea that the things people find meaning in can be very different kinds of things. You know, I sort of mention a couple of different thinkers here that I find, you know, really impressive and important about this. So maybe you've heard of John Rawls. There's a name that's somewhat familiar. And in his political philosophy, he talks a lot about what he calls the conception of the good. Just the idea that for each person, we have a notion of the good that sort of shapes our lives. And that varies a lot from person to person. And in some cases, it takes the form of, you know, relationships, often familiar relationships, but not just familiar relationships. It takes the form of different kinds of careers or other projects that we sort of invest ourselves in. You think about the organizations that maybe you volunteer for or work for, the causes that you take to be centrally important. And here, I think, there's something to celebrate about the diversity of the kinds of things that we find meaning in. And so that said, I'll move on and say something more complicated about the other pieces. So let's move on here. And here's where I want to start to point out ways in which I think the bar can be high in thinking about what we're searching for and also how we're searching. And so the search for truth and meaning, the other part of this being truth. What I want to suggest is, whereas with meaning, this piece of what we're searching for says something primarily about us, I think when we think about the concept of truth, we ought to think about it as something about how we understand the world around us. And what I want to suggest, and I'm going to go through some examples in a second to illustrate this, and so here's a place where you might push back in comments, but I'm gonna go with this. Here's a place where I want to suggest that I think the language that we often use around truth can sometimes mislead us into thinking that truth is primarily, or at least highly relativized to individuals. When we use phrases like my truth or your truth, and I don't want to say those aren't meaningful. In fact, I have an example where I think it is. But I think primarily our interest in truth has to do with truth about the world, that has to do with how we share the experience of the world. And so in that respect, I guess I want to suggest today that the bar is high here, that we ought to hold ourselves to certain standards of how we engage the world and evaluate it. If you go to the next slide, Kim, you'll have some examples where I think you'll see this. First off, a definition. And this is, you know, I think as a philosopher, I can't resist definitions. So what is truth, first off? Truth is, again, we could talk a lot about this, but at base, the most common understanding of truth is that it's a property of propositions. That is, where a proposition, now this is a little bit too much in the weeds, a proposition is sort of the content of a sentence, right? So if I utter a sentence in one language or another, those are different sentences. Right, but presumably the content can be the same. And so we can ask about the content of propositions. Are they true or are they false? And so here's four examples. Let me just go through them, and I want to say something brief about each of them, although, again, there's potentially a lot to say here. So mint chocolate chip is the best flavor of ice cream. Now, I take it, if I were to, I don't believe that, by the way, I'd go black raspberry. But I went mint chocolate chip, by the way, because I feel like that's one where I bring it up. Some people really like it, but some people really don't like it. Anyway, I thought about this too much, maybe. So look, hypothetically, if I were to utter this sentence, right, mint chocolate chip is the best flavor of ice cream, I take it, in uttering this sentence, this is one of those cases where I think that highly relativized notion of truth is appropriate. Right, that is, right, I would be saying that as something that is true for me, but that I wouldn't assume or try to argue is true for you. That is, if you came along and you said, you know, no, you know, black raspberry is the best flavor of ice cream or chocolate or whatever, right? That I wouldn't try to convince you otherwise. That would sort of be strange to do that. And so in this respect, right, I think here's an example of a kind of sentence where I think it does make sense to say, look, this is my truth. And if your truth is, you know, chocolate is the best, good for you. That's awesome. And we each have our own truth, and that's fantastic. And so this is a nod to saying, I think that there are cases where that notion of truth as a relativized thing is appropriate. But I think there's all kinds of cases where it's not, some of which matter a lot. I think I pick a simple example here, mostly because it's true by definition. Triangles have three sides, right? I mean, if I came along and I said, triangles have four sides, you wouldn't think, well, great, that's your truth. My truth is that triangles have three sides, right? I take it you would think, well, in fact, you'd think conceptually I've made a deep mistake, right? You might even not know where to begin, right? Because I simply misunderstood the concept. And so I take it here's probably the most kind of straightforward case of where truth is not relativized. In fact, I'd be wrong if I said that sentence were false. But now there's a range of kinds of sentences that are more complicated. Here's a second one. Human activity is a significant cause of climate change. Now, I take it that is a sentence that some people, in fact, do deny, right? That they say, you know, I take this to be false. Now, it's an empirical question, fundamentally. Right? That is, there's an empirical fact of the matter, I take it, about whether or not human activity is a significant cause of climate change or not. Now, how we investigate and understand empirical questions generally is not always easy, right? But I do take it, here's a case where, and granted I picked one that's a little bit loaded, huh? But here's a case where I think you could plausibly argue, right, that we have sufficiently investigated this empirical question to sort of settle the fact of the matter about it, right? Such that if I uttered if I denied this, I take it for many of you, you would think, hold on a minute, that's not just your truth. You're in fact wrong about that. And let's talk about it, and we can sort of see maybe you're misunderstanding the evidence, maybe you are, you know, maybe you're just not aware of the evidence, something like that. But I take it we would point to evidence of some form offered by someone that we take to be an expert having gathered the evidence, right, to sort of say, hold on a minute here, there's more to say than just we disagree. Okay, this one, loaded, topical. I was looking for a moral example too, where I recognize the idea that moral claims can be true or false is certainly a complicated one. But at least on the face of it, I want to resist, and here's something we could talk a whole lot more about. I want to resist the idea that simply because someone's uttered a moral claim that there's simply nothing more to say about it. In fact, I think there's good reason to think that when people make moral claims, like if I were to deny that flying buildings into planes was immoral, right, that I think the same kind of discourse that we would have engaged in if I denied this third one would probably seem plausible to you. That is, you'd want to understand why I thought that. You would think that I have misunderstood some relevant reasons bearing on that claim, right? And that is something that you would think I'm plausibly wrong about. And so it's controversial, right? Because whereas I take it this kind of question is purely empirical, this one is somewhat more conceptual, right? Because we would have to understand something about the moral status of persons, and when the killing of an innocent person could ever be morally justified. And those are very complicated questions, but I don't want to simply pass them off as things that we can't make progress in without meaningful discourse. And so if you go to the next slide, I want to offer this sort of preliminarily as a way of dividing up the different kinds of claims we might assert as true or false. Here's a question you can ask about any claim. Is it the sort of claim for which we would muster reasons of any kind, empirical or otherwise, to which we would hold other people accountable? And what I want to suggest today is that if the answer to that for any claim is yes, then we ought to resist the temptation to relativize a truth claim as simply true for you but not for me. right? That I think there's something fundamentally social to how we engage the world around us that this captures, that I think does raise the bar for how we think about what's true and what's false. And so I think, again, here, I mean, you go back to the ice cream example. I think you'd sort of say, well, I don't like mint chocolate chip. And I'd say, oh, okay, right? And there would be nothing more to say. But if I were to sit here and say, you know what, actually, you know, my stock example in the moral case is sort of torturing kittens, right? So if I were to say, you know, I think it's perfectly fine to torture a kitten for fun, right? And you were to say, well, I disagree, right? You'd want to push me a little bit further, right, about why we could treat kittens that way or something like that, right? And I think that's an example of a place where we ought to think that truth is a meaningful thing that we can find in a lot of cases. And so if that's right, then I think the search for truth as opposed to the search for meaning is not something that is highly relativized, right? That is, I think we have some responsibilities there to sort of understand the world in ways that we can talk meaningfully about with respect to how we do or don't offer reasons for the claims that we stake out. But that's controversial. There'd be a lot more to say here. But in the promise I offered earlier of saying something brief and moving on, I'm going to move on to the other side of the equation, because there I've got something to say about both sides. All right. Free and responsible search for truth and reason. There was the question of what we're searching for. There's the question of how we're searching. Free and responsible. Again, I'm going to take these in reverse order. What does it mean? I mean, imagine if it were simply a search for truth and meaning. I mean, that's not incoherent, right? But presumably we think something meaningful is added by saying that we're looking for a responsible search for truth and meaning. So what does that mean? Here again, in the sort of way, at least in my mind, it made sense to separate the pieces here. In how we're searching, I want to suggest that adding this piece, calling the search a responsible search, says something primarily about the world around us and what we owe to others in how we're searching. And what I want to suggest, and by the way, this is, you know, I sort of apologize to Pam, you got stuck with a mouthful of opening words today. But here's a place where, you know, so when Penny asked me for opening, if I had suggested for opening closing words, my answer to that is always yes. Probably William Clifford is not a name that's familiar to most of you. He was primarily a mathematician in the 19th century. But he has this paper, an essay called The Ethics of Belief that I find to be a very compelling read, and a particularly argument he makes and I find very compelling. And I thought I would share briefly the main thrust of that essay today, because I think it captures how I think we ought to think about responsibility. Specifically, what I want to suggest is that I think probably most of us can agree that there is moral responsibility in how we act towards others. I mean, unless you simply deny the category of morality, right? All right? That is, if you accept at all that we have moral responsibilities, then I take it straightforwardly that lives in how we act towards others, right? So, you know, if I were to walk up to a stranger on the street and sort of hit them, right, that presumably right away you would say, whatever else that was, illegal or whatever, you would say that's immoral. I shouldn't hit someone just for no good reason, right? That I owe it to them not to do that. And in fact, this is a common way to think about morality, right? That is, morality concerns how we act in the ways that affect other people. I'll move on from that. So I just want to say, if you take morality to be a category at all, I think that's uncontroversial. But here's what is potentially more controversial, and what I am nodding to Clifford in arguing briefly today, that I think we also have responsibilities in the beliefs that we hold. Even when it's not obvious that you can draw a straight line from any particular belief to any particular action. And so when I say here beliefs are private affairs, what I believe is a purely personal matter, that's what I take to be wrong, or at least what I want to argue on behalf of Clifford against. So if you go to the next slide, this will dig into this just a little bit. So here's an obvious case, I think, right here, where we can think about a belief and see it directly tied to an action, right? So if I believe that certain kinds of people are inferior to others, now, and so, you know, pick any category you like, right? Whether it's category of work or religious belief or sexual preference or sexual orientation or religious, whatever category you sort of list there, right? If I held that belief, right? So imagine I believe that, anyone who, works at a college is inferior to others, right? Right? Now, I take it right away, you might be troubled by my holding of that belief, right? Because you would say, well, that's the kind of belief that is very likely to directly translate into you treating, the employees of colleges in ways that are sort of inferior to others. And so you shouldn't do that, so you shouldn't hold that kind of belief. And maybe that's controversial, maybe it's not. But I take it there's also a range of beliefs that I think we might ordinarily take to be purely private beliefs. And so an example I sometimes like to use, just because it's sort of fun to think about, is what I call the belief in star dragons. So imagine for a moment that you believe in what I will call the standard astronomical story of suns and stars, right? So that is, you believe that when I look up at the sky and I see the sun, that is in fact an enormous ball of gas, and you know there's a fascinating chemical story to tell about, you know, I don't know what. See, here's where I'm a philosopher and not a, you know, a chemist or a physicist. But you know, whatever is involved in the standard astronomical story you learn in science class, you buy it, right? So you know, so I come along and I say, I like your astronomical story. I respect that you hold that. I believe something different. I believe that when I look up at the sky and I see the sun is the result of star dragons. What are star dragons? Star dragons are beings that exist in space. Dragons. What do dragons do?
Breathe fire.
Breathe fire, right? And so if you had enough eternal fire-breathing dragons in space, flying in a circle around each other, what would you likely get? A ball of flame, right? I mean, look, you're looking at me like, well, okay, this is a silly example. It sort of is, I think. But on the flip side, you know, imagine if I really did believe this in a kind of earnest way, right? And I were to say to you something like, well, you know, look, if I ever went to the sun, I didn't find star dragons, maybe I'll start to buy your story. But we can't do that. I like my star dragon story. I'm going with that. Now, on the one hand, you might think, oh, you know, it's kind of crazy, but whatever. If it makes him happy, that's great. You know, that's a kind of belief, I think, that you might want to think is purely personal. So there's nothing to be said, I mean, here's the angle, right, with respect to responsibility, what we owe to others, in a belief like that, you might think. But enter Clifford. The fellow who I offered the opening words from today. Clifford makes the following argument that I find compelling. And again, here's one where we could spend, again, a lot of time. I'll just offer the sort of the move he makes and then move along. According to Clifford, no belief is purely private because even if you take a belief like the belief in star dragons, right, the belief that you might think is purely personal, has nothing to do with anyone else. That belief becomes a part, in a sense, here's a maybe a rough analogy for it, becomes a part of my sort of web of beliefs. And it doesn't just form a part of that web of beliefs, but it says something, it has an effect on the standards according to which I believe. Right? So the idea is, right, my willingness to believe in star dragons in the face of the massive accumulated evidence for the standard astronomical story of what suns are and how they work, right, has an impact on how I believe in other kinds of cases, right? It makes me more likely to believe things that you might find more directly objectionable. Right? If I'm willing to stare down and ignore evidence in a case like that, it will make me more willing to stare down and ignore evidence in other cases. And what's driving all of this for Clifford, which again is something I find plausible, in fact, some of what I've already said may suggest this, right? For Clifford, this fundamentally has to do with the way that we are social beings, right? We're embedded with each other all the time, interacting with each other, standing for causes, voting, right? And insofar as that's unavoidably true, right, that we have responsibilities to others, not just in what we do, but in what we believe. Right? And so, you know, I had in here and then I pulled it out for the sake of time, a range of quotes from Clifford. But for Clifford, he gets very, maybe emotional is too strong, but he really gets quite passionate about this, right? The idea being, right, that if you were simply to say, I've got no time to evaluate this, that's not important to me, that you really are, in one of the most fundamental ways, failing others. That's strong. But I also think there's something compelling about it. And so to the extent that what we're talking about here, right, is the search for truth and meaning, and I take it we find that to be something that is, in some deep ways, quite personal, I at least want to suggest that the notion of doing this responsibly may cut deeper than you think. Right? That is, it may cut across all of the things that we're taking to be true and so believing. So it says Clifford anyway. All right, but moving along. One more, freedom. It's actually kind of funny how memory works. So I said this a few minutes ago, you could do a whole class on this. And then I went back and I thought, wait a minute, I did that. This is true, it's true. When I was in grad school, almost 20 years ago, I took a whole seminar on autonomy. And so anyway, maybe it's sad that I'd forgotten that. But Some of what I will say, though, I suppose, is connected with that class, at least in some dim ways, I hope. So look, first off, the general claim, given the way I've been dividing things. In how we're searching, I want to suggest this notion of this expectation of freedom. I mean, on the one hand, it's about us, right? But it's about us, and I think in a complicated way. Because it says something about what needs to be true of us for the search to be, I think, ultimately a meaningful one. And I think in that respect, it's connected. I wanted to avoid this way of saying it, but I'm going to say it this way, and then maybe you'll see what I mean and not be too uncharitable to me about it. I want to say it's connected in some deep ways with what is owed to each of us individually by everybody else, by sort of how we organize ourselves in the society we live in. That's a big claim, though. But let me start here, and maybe you'll see what I'm getting at. Here's a, I think, a very common view of what freedom involves, right? That is, to be free is to be unbounded by constraints. That is, you know, when I'm constrained, I'm not free, right? And so you might think, in reverse, right, when I lack those constraints, right, then I am free. And one sort of common example you often get here is the example of, right, prisoners, right? That is, a prisoner is taken to be the quintessential example of someone who lacks freedom, right, because they're constrained in some significant ways. And so, therefore, you might then think this is how we ought to analyze the concept of freedom generally, right, as having to do with a lack of constraint. Here's my one image. It's always dangerous to go with pop culture references because you don't know who's going to know them or not. But yeah, so my wife knew this one. Good. I don't know how many of you saw the movie The Shawshank Redemption. But if, yeah, okay, I see some hands. If not, it's okay. I'll talk a little bit about it. If you had, by the way, this is sort of a kind of a poignant scene from the movie. So Brooks is one of the main characters, or one of the characters in the movie, and he is basically a prison lifer, right? That is, he was imprisoned very, very young, and now, as we enter the movie, he's much older, and as it happens, about to be freed from prison. Now, boy, there's a spoiler here I shouldn't give because it's such a great movie. You should see the movie. Let's just say freedom for Brooks isn't all it's cracked up to be. Right? That is, for Brooks, he gets out of prison. And you might think, wow, in prison, constrained, lacked freedom. Now, out of prison, so free, unconstrained. Brooks is lost when he comes out of prison. Right? Just in a fundamental way, not equipped to sort of live in a functional, flourishing way in society. I take it this kind of example is one that tells us something about freedom more generally. You can go to the next slide. So here's a notion that I'm borrowing from, actually a lot of people, Kant, Hegel, Isaiah Berlin, a bunch of others. And it's a distinction between this notion of positive and negative freedom, or positive and negative liberty. They're often used interchangeably in the literature. Here's a distinction. Negative freedom is the kind of freedom I talked about two slides ago, right? Freedom as not being constrained, right? That is, when I'm a prisoner in chains, right? I lack freedom. When I'm unchained and so free from those constraints, I have a kind of freedom, right? And this is sort of the key towards what I'm trying to say about this principle. Right? I have that negative freedom. But negative freedom is a different kind of thing from what is, in contrast, called positive freedom. Where, you know, autonomy, I find autonomy to be a really interesting word, right? If you know the etymology of the word, right, auto self nomos law. Right? So the etymology of the word is self-law. And I think that's a really interesting thing to think about just for a second, right? Because when we think about laws, one way of understanding laws is as a kind of constraint, right? If you think about, for example, the view to sort of minimize laws against everything from, I don't know what, you know, jaywalking to drug distribution to whatever, right? They're often framed, particularly by those of a more libertarian persuasion, neither positive nor negative judgment of those, right, as a kind of way of freeing us from certain unjustified constraints. But this notion of self-law is an interesting one, right? Because I think law, in a sense, does constrain, but there's a way in which the idea of giving yourself the law, right, is a different and richer concept, right? So here I say very generally, what does it mean to give yourself a law, right? What does it mean to govern yourself? And I take it has to do with something, and all the pieces here I think are important. Reflectively, right? Forming, choosing, being equipped to pursue a conception of the good. I think this is an ideal, but I think it's a really foundational appeal. In fact, I want to suggest that there's a way in which this ideal is deeply connected to something that many of us can relate to, right? Having children. I mean, as you think about what it means to be a parent, where I take it children are, especially young children, sort of classical examples of people who really aren't self-governed in a meaningful way, right? That is, they start to learn how to make choices over time, right? But the notion of reflectively choosing, right, and pursuing a conception of the good is one that is really quite a dense concept. And I take it one goal we often have as parents is to equip our children over time to become the sorts of people who can do that. But I take it there's a recognition there. It's not automatic. And in fact, it's not easy. And in fact, there's a whole lot of threats to autonomy. Right? And so when you think about your children as an example, I mean, I take it, you know, when you think about people who belong to a cult, there's another maybe too easy example, right, of people who, for whatever reason, and there's a complex psychological and sociological story to tell, right, but they lack, right, the kind of reflective choosing that we take to be quintessential to meaningful self-government. And here's a nod. Some of you, I know summer services are a little bit trickier. Here's a nod to a service just from a few weeks ago. For those of you who are here, John Givens came from an organization that he runs called Circle of Support. And for, if you weren't here, it's an organization that works with people who were recently released from prison to provide them with a kind of support network, right, that will put them in a position to, I think most fundamentally, although maybe I'm twisting this to serve my own purposes, to make good choices. Right, to make good choices. And part of what I think was so, for me at least, so awesome about his organization was he could point to the evidence of how significantly recidivism rates had dropped among those who participated in it. And now you can ask why, right? And what I want to suggest today is this is deeply tied to this notion of positive freedom, right? That is, it takes a lot to be free. And there are all kinds of threats to freedom, all kinds of them, in the social structures we operate in the way that laws work, right, in the pressures that we face, right, from those around us. And any of those kinds of things can, in a real way, I think, undermine freedom. And so when we talk about, it's over here, right, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, and when I say the bar is high here about freedom, I think in some ways this is the highest of all the bars I'm talking about today, because I really do think if we take this principle seriously, what it means is we ought to think, and I think we do very often, especially frankly in this group, but I think we have a responsibility to think really seriously about what we can do to put others in a position to be free in this meaningful way of positive freedom. And the ways in which implicitly, accidentally, so not on purpose, we sometimes support structures that threaten freedom in the meaningful way that I think we care about when we care about that principle. So I talked enough now. So this is so here's just a brief summary, because I hit a lot of stuff today. So free and responsible search for truth and meaning, and what we're searching for, like I said, with meaning, I think that's primarily about us, and I think here, we shouldn't set a high bar for what people find meaning in. We ought to embrace the very different kinds of things that people find meaning in. But when we're searching for truth, I do think that the bar is high here, or at least we ought to resist relativizing it too much. And then with respect to responsibility, again, this is about what we owe to others. And again, here I want to suggest that the things we believe are connected with responsibility and freedom. The bar's high here too, as I just argued. Anyway, I'll stop now so we have enough time to talk for a little bit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For our closing words, Leila Barr will read.
Hi. I didn't practice, so. Okay. We might, over and above all this, add to what man acquires in the civil state moral liberty, which alone makes him truly master of himself. For the mere impulse of appetite is slavery, while obedience to a law which we prescribe to ourselves is liberty. Jean Jacques Rousseau, am I saying that right? All right, thanks.
Thank you, Leah.
Yeah.
So if you would, extend the hand of friendship. Enjoy coffee, and notice that Just Bakery is here this morning.